sixth and final paramita is wisdom, which again is a very complex subject. Generally in Buddhism we speak of wisdom in three ways. There is intellectual wisdom, there is contemplative wisdom, and there is meditative wisdom. And a quote from one particular traditional text explains this to the effect that the first is one's study and intellectual understanding of the concepts of Dharma, which is the basis for the development of the other kinds of wisdom. First one needs to understand, and then taking that understanding, one thinks about it again and again, turns it over, reflects upon it, contemplates it, to come to some deeper level of understanding. And then one really takes it to its fullest extent through meditation. So in order to say that one is really wise, that one has really learned and understood something, it needs to go, from the Buddhist approach, through these different stages of intellectual understanding, contemplation, and then meditation to an actual intuitive realization of what is being talked about. In previous times, in other situations, it's often been the case that people who were interested in receiving spiritual teaching simply couldn't find teachers, which posed a great problem for them. It has also been the case in many instances that teachers couldn't find students, which caused equally a problem. In this particular situation, we seem to have a teacher and we seem to have students. We seem to have everything we need in this situation. If people have any questions, therefore, at this point that they would like to pose, any doubts, anything they would like clarified, please feel free.
Yes, I'm very attracted to the idea of patience as far as lay feet. So I have some reservations to express as what would be problems in the patient. One would be the environment. If one was in great pain, one might desire to take an apartment. And I would appreciate a comment on
in great pain.
Yes,
do you mean a painkiller or do you mean a drug to induce?
Good question. Anyhow, so in that
case,
the patient's dying now or taking something called cocktails, which are a combination of cocaine and morphine. And those are very heavy drugs and toxic. But used medically, but nonetheless, it's toxic. So I would have reservations in case I should hit myself with that pain condition. Then the second reservation would be, for instance, if I was filled with parasites, which are obesity, and I would want to kill them because I wouldn't want to have them in my body. And I wouldn't appreciate a comment on it.
Just to repeat the question for A, the benefit of the audience that's in here, and B, for the tape. The lady is asking about taking the five precepts, indicating that she has the interest in taking the five lay precepts, but has some reservations that she would prefer to check before doing so, specifically the vow concerning intoxicants, because the fifth vow, which is an auxiliary to the four main vows, is to abandon the use of intoxicants. Now, supposing one were placed in a situation where intense pain made it desirable to take a painkiller, and the example was used of a certain concoction of cocaine and morphine which is being used for cancer patients to relieve the suffering of the disease. Does that constitute, if one has taken a vow against intoxicants, what constitutes an intoxicant, I think, is the first question. Does a painkiller, a pure painkiller, constitute that? In that it alters one's perception, and would something like that constitute breaking one's vow? The second constitutes the use of antibiotics, I assume. Any drug which is to kill a form of life that is in one's body, a bacteria or a parasite, which is either killing or injuring one. And in order to get rid of the disease, one has to deliberately kill the being. So if one has taken a vow not to kill, does that constitute killing and breaking the vow? So how do these two specific situations relate to the five precepts?
The 슈베가 되어라 했으면 그런 도파니어에 희희 장강 여벌은 줄 알았으면 통곡을 내치래 한빈선 소속인 내가 동탄 나사야 된 동화 전부 지시원하는 민식자는 동화된 매파 서로가 매파 진로기어래 이니언 성성 맨대랑 되니 여벌은 줄 알았으면 샘라 남자 몸을 슈미어래 그런 패시션에 되니 당장 나사 캔서 혹은 몸부이어래 그리고 동화 슈체물에 상당히 면 슈체물 되기어래 동화 매파 서기어래 이니언 샘동
Talon, the Shibin, Namjur, Tinsama, Tabachi, Mumbo, Shumi, Nasa, Shumdu, Nandi, and Rabazan, the Tal, Nasa, Tabachi, 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 Nasa
In the first case, the use of intoxicants implies a state of intoxication, which implies a certain heedlessness or a certain frivolous approach, which is being discouraged. The actual medicinal use of such substances does not come under the vow. At that point, it is a specific treatment, or at least part of a treatment for a specific disease, and is a very deliberate and sober decision by a doctor and a patient to do so. It doesn't imply the usual frivolous and heedless attitude that we associate with the word intoxication. So one would not be breaking one's vow to accept that kind of medication or that kind of drug if the circumstances warranted it. In the second case, it is true that one takes the vow not to kill. The single act which is the most fundamental is the taking of human life. So someone who has taken that vow, whether this is, we're speaking of a monk or a nun or a lay person, someone who has taken that vow not to kill forfeits that ordination, has severed the ordination if they deliberately murder a human being, if they deliberately take human life. Other acts of killing, taking other forms of life, is by no means to be encouraged. It is definitely a very negative thing. But it does not constitute rupturing the vow completely, totally destroying the ordination. It constitutes an infraction rather than a violation and a complete severing of the vow that one has taken. Now, in the specific case of parasites or infections which require the use of antibiotics, the situation here is one in which one has to accept the unfortunate reality of the situation. One's life is perhaps threatened by these creatures through no fault of theirs and no fault of one's own. One has this ailment which is going to kill one, perhaps. Certainly it's going to impede one's health and one's ability to be effective. Now, if one lets those creatures kill one, that's perhaps a kind of generosity. It's literally holding to the spirit of the vow, but they end up dying anyway. As soon as one dies, the body rots, they have no place left to live, and that whole population of creatures dies anyway. So that's one thing. It's not going to benefit them in the long run anyway. On the other hand, if one does save one's own precious human birth, one has that much more time to use it, not only to purify the karma of having taken that life, but also to benefit those beings, quite possibly. This is allowing oneself more time for the development of that precious opportunity, which is not something that should be wasted lightly. So in that particular case, to begin with, on a formal level, it is an infraction of the vow rather than a destroying of the vow. And also on a more practical level, it is dealing, perhaps not skillfully, but dealing as skillfully as possible with a very unfortunate situation. that one is required to take a lower form of life in order to save a higher one, because that higher form of life offers far more potential in the moment for spiritual development and can be a source of benefit to those lower forms of life as well. So that would be the approach from the point of view of the formal ordination and that particular situation using antibiotics. Concerns these six paramitas or perfections that were discussed, or at least some discussed in detail and some mentioned briefly tonight, how they relate one to the other. For example, if we have generosity, do we have the patience of generosity and the diligence of generosity and so forth, each one tying in with all the others? And are these considered specific antidotes for specific emotional poisons, the specific emotional responses in the mind?
Tata taro dushin man rung rung wa de tam jani chi di chi ba de rung rung tena chen ba sotrum sotrum kong rung tena chen de zo kan tam chen de tsun rung tete chen ma tam sotrum di chen ma tam chi di chi ba tam jani ga wa chi yo re Not only do these six paramitas relate one to the other, not only are the other five complete in any one of them, but any given situation embodies all six, or at least can embody all six. Suppose we take the example of everyone coming here tonight to hear a teaching. Now, people have contributed financially, they've contributed their time and energy to come here. They've put aside all other things they might be doing, given up those, and have chosen to come here. That's a kind of generosity. They have a certain kind of morality in that they're here for a specific purpose. They're not here for any other kind of diversion. They're not here for any other kind of reason than what they're here for. And in being concentrated on that, guarding against any kind of frivolity or dissipation or distraction from the situation, is the principle of morality. The patience is being able to sit for a certain period of time, perhaps one's tired or hungry or uncomfortable, but nevertheless one's sufficiently interested that one puts up with these minor discomforts and listens to what's going on. That's patience. There is diligence or energy in that one strives to really pay attention in what is going on, tries not to let one's attention wander, tries not to think about other things, get distracted, but to actually pay attention to what's going on. That's the diligence and energy one's putting into the situation. One's attempting to really bring these things home to the mind, really let the mind dwell on what is taking place. That's the fifth paramita of meditative or mental stability.
And one is really trying to understand, not only to understand on an intellectual level, but really see what's going on, really experience what's going on. That is the aspect of wisdom. So in that one situation, we could say that all six are present. The potential, at least, exists for all six of those qualities to be present. Now, it is true that there is some connection, a great deal of connection, between these six paramitas and the six fundamental emotions in the mind. For example, we can say that generosity is an antidote to avarice and greed, that morality is an antidote to lust and desire. And so on a one-to-one level, a great deal could be said about this, but it's important to remember that the most far-reaching effect is that of wisdom. That the sixth paramita, the wisdom and understanding of the emotions, is the single most significant contributing factor to being able to deal with emotions and to eliminate the negative influence of one's emotional confusion. Without wisdom, the other five will be limited in their success. So the sixth aspect of wisdom, the perfection of wisdom, is important as the capper, as what finally allows one to deal most effectively and thoroughly with emotional confusion. The question is, sometimes when one is, for example, reciting a mantra such as Om Mani Padme Hum, someone overhears you, and rather than there seeming to be benefit, the person reacts in a negative way. They think you're crazy. They have some kind of misunderstanding of what's going on, and they react the wrong way. How does one deal with that? That problem is simply that the person has misunderstood the situation, but as long as there is benefit, or rather, as long as there is a desire to benefit in one's own mind, if it's being done from a sincere desire to benefit the other person, then that benefit and the benefit of them hearing the mantra far outweigh their negative reaction. Because it's simply their ignorance in the situation. It's not that there's something inherently wrong with the situation. As long as there is the sincerity on one's own part and the use of that skillful method, then the other person's reaction is not going to destroy the benefit of that.
Lady back there.
I have two different questions. One is about when yesterday we spoke about compassion, you also mentioned devotion. And I would like to know about the generation of devotion. Sometimes I feel myself falling.
The two questions are first concerning the talk last night where, as well as compassion, devotion was mentioned. And how is this devotion developed? How is it generated? Secondly, the word sincere was used tonight, and since this is a term which is subject to interpretation, what is meant by sincere attitude or sincere motivation in this context?
I'm going to go to the hospital.
Matilda, j'adore Dieu.
The development or generation of devotion depends upon one understanding just what one is devoted towards, the qualities that inspire one's devotion. For example, when we say we have faith in or devotion to Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, our gurus, it implies that we understand what they represent, what kind of qualities they embody, which inspire that devotion in us. So in a certain sense, it's not a case of generating devotion so much as really understanding those qualities. Once they have been understood, it inspires the devotion spontaneously without one having to work at it. Because as you say, without this understanding, it's very difficult simply to generate devotion when one feels one should. It's a question of why one is generating the devotion. In what is one generating that devotion? This is one of the reasons why we have Dharma centers with Lama's teaching, is to explain to people what something like Buddhahood or Bodhisattva realization implies, what kind of qualities it embodies, what kind of benefits it implies for oneself and others, and what the function of a spiritual teacher is, how a spiritual teacher or a guru helps one to discover that. Through understanding those kind of qualities and potentials and benefits in the situation, one's devotion is inspired spontaneously. So it's to do very much with one's understanding. Now, as far as what constitutes a sincere attitude, on a very general level, we could say that if the attitude is one of benefiting others rather than oneself in a situation, that is the most sincere attitude. Whereas as long as there is self-interest in the situation, that sincerity is sullied. Particularly if there's the desire to hurt the other person, of course. I mean, the worst kind of attitude we could think of is a malevolent one, going into a situation trying to hurt the other person or injure the other person. Whereas if the attitude is solely to help the other, then we're talking about a really sincere attitude, a really pure attitude. There's a story which the Tibetans often tell to illustrate this point, which is one of a mother and daughter walking along the banks of a river that was in full spate, and they both fell in and were able to grab each other by the hand and were being carried along by this torrent. Now, neither of them could swim. And as they were drowning in the water, the only thing each one was thinking of was the other's safety. And so the mother was thinking to herself, I don't care if I can't live, if only my daughter doesn't drown, if only my daughter lives. And the daughter, on her part, was thinking, if only my mother lives. I don't care about myself, if only my mother lives. Now, they both died because they couldn't swim, but because of that pure and sincere attitude of helping the other, in their minds, when they died, they were immediately reborn in a god's realm, a very high state of samsaric rebirth, the simple merit of that thought. So the implication is the predominance of the concern for others in one's attitudes, the degree of sincerity being determined by the degree to which there is that concern for others in what one does.
Jarabuchi, Samaras, Tayan, Sarabra Chamutu Sakatus, Tanayara, Mara, Sama Samutanga Masakata, then a mama Shapani, then a Langatina, Tarim was the Dayana, then Nimata Kakam, Sharakala Kawayana, then Satila, Tumakalasako, Duna, Machita Malasona.
There is an illustration which His Holiness the Dalai Lama gave once, which I find a very fine example of the distinction between noble and ignoble attitudes and before the other person. Now suppose he drinks the whole glass for himself, doesn't even have any thought of the other, and just drinks it for himself. That's an inferior man. That is a completely thoughtless, inconsiderate person, and that kind of attitude cannot be encouraged. Suppose that person drinks half the glass. They need to drink themselves, so they drink half the glass, but they're always thinking of the other person, and they think, that person's coming along in a few minutes, I'll just leave that glass for them to find. And they leave half a glass of water. Now that's the attitude of a superior person. That person has thought for benefiting someone else. And the distinction is as simple as that. The consideration for others and the desire to help and benefit others. Is it better to only give when the giving comes from the heart, or is it better, even when the one is not really moved to generosity, to give anyway, trying to develop this quality, trying to instill this generosity that comes from the heart in all situations? When we're speaking about generosity, we're implying that it comes from the heart. That seems to be the definition of generosity. Now, there's generosity, or at least the sharing, to give something without really wanting to, or without really being concerned. One simply kind of casually or somewhat cynically gives something when one doesn't really feel like one wants to. There's benefit there, certainly not as much as there could be. But in order for there to be that really heartfelt generosity, that's going to depend upon one's compassion. So rather than trying to make it come from the heart, the way one brings it out, the way it comes out from the heart, is by one thinking about the suffering of that other being. Why is one moved in a particular situation to give at all? Well, because the other being is suffering on some level, needs some kind of help on some level. And when one has understood the suffering and limitations of that other being's situation, that's how one develops really heartfelt generosity, rather than trying to force it in the immediate situation, because that's very limited benefit trying to do that. Certainly, they will benefit in the short term from one's so-called generosity, but it's not going to be really heartfelt. And the way it is heartfelt is due to one's compassion. There's somebody
in the back there. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Kind of patience was mentioned, that is spiritual patience, and three kinds were mentioned, so there would seem to be two other aspects. Could Rinpoche share those? The three aspects of patience which are often mentioned in the teachings, the first of these is patience in our normal sense of the word. When someone else harms one, or when something is frustrating one, when any obstacle is presenting itself or himself or herself, one is able to meet the situation with forbearance. This is in a strictly worldly context. So one can meet any hardship, meet any obstacle, any trial with patience and forbearance, and not lose one's patience and give into anger or else give up. But one can see it through. The second aspect that is mentioned is this spiritual patience we mentioned, that of being able to deal with any hardships or frustrations one experiences in one's strictly within the context of one's spiritual practice. And the third is simply the full extension of both of those, that until one attains enlightenment, one is going to need the patience to carry through all these kind of obstacles. And so the third kind of patience is really just the culmination of patience in being able to see one right through to the final goal, to the attainment of complete enlightenment. And so these other two aspects, simply being carried through to their culmination, are sometimes mentioned as a third aspect of patience. Ideally, the question was, how does one develop skillful means in generosity? Ideally, this is going to depend upon the sixth aspect of wisdom which we spoke of, which enhances and pervades all of the other five. That the more one is clear about what one is doing, the more skillful one's going to be at doing it, regardless of whether it's generosity or any other of the perfections. Now, insofar as one may not have developed this wisdom at this point, about all one has to go on is whether one's generosity is motivated either by faith and devotion or love and compassion, as we mentioned, the two aspects of generosity. The aspect of worship and offering due to one's faith and devotion, and the aspect of sharing due to one's love and compassion. If these are the motivating factors, then this is as accurate a rule of thumb as one is going to find in the present circumstances. That if one's generosity is motivated either from this faith or from this compassion, one really cannot be going wrong. One's actual skill in particular situations is only going to improve as one's wisdom deepens, one's overall view of the situation deepens. Exactly how this principle of wisdom applies to something like generosity is described traditionally as follows, that the real perfection of the consummation of generosity is in understanding that the giver, that the act of giving and the object of the generosity are ultimately unreal. That this is something which is merely taking place without being ultimately real. It simply appears to be real without being so. And once one has seen the essential emptiness of the experience and the giving takes place in that framework, then one can truly be said to have perfected generosity. That is the ultimate in generosity. In fact, one's generosity that is motivated by faith and by compassion is developing one's merit. And this development of merit automatically leads to a deepening of awareness. And so it is these initial efforts at generosity based upon one's faith and compassion that lead one to deeper states of understanding and realization and enhance one's the wisdom aspect of what one is doing and permit one to develop that deeper understanding. If one hears about these kinds of profound concepts and simply thinks to oneself, that's way beyond me, I simply couldn't do that, then already one's lost one kind of patience. And in fact, we find reference traditionally to this particular kind of patience, the patience to be able to put up with profound concepts. Tell us what taking refuge is and what are the benefits of that step. In Buddhism, when we speak of taking refuge, we mention three spiritual principles. We refer to these as the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. What these imply are a state of being. These embody a state of being where there is complete freedom and control. Freedom of mind and control over one's experience. We don't have that at this present time. We lack that freedom and we lack that control. Taking refuge in those spiritual principles which embody that state of freedom and that state of control makes a connection where traditionally this is referred to as the hook of compassion and blessing meeting the ring of one's faith. And as long as there's that openness in one's mind, which is the ring, then that connection can be made and one can be drawn towards, one is motivated towards and drawn towards that attainment oneself. So that's one very important benefit of and function of taking refuge. It simply directs one towards, draws one towards that attainment oneself. There is also, on a more pragmatic level perhaps, the blessing and merit of taking refuge and honoring and having faith in such spiritual principles, which in and of itself constitutes a significant blessing and a significant source of merit. So that if one is sincerely taking refuge, if one is really honestly motivated by this faith in these spiritual principles and ideals, then one need not worry about falling into lower states of existence. The blessing of this will continue to draw one towards this state of realization oneself. The formal taking of the vows of refuge in a ceremony, which is the basis for Buddhist practice, is simply the formalization of that faith that one has in the three jewels as spiritual ideals. It does not constitute any explicit or implicit denial of one's activity in the world. It does not limit one on that level, nor does it imply any rejection of any other spiritual system. It does not imply that one should not or cannot have faith in other spiritual systems, cannot be involved with them. It simply implies that one does have the faith that the three jewels are spiritual ideals which represent this source of blessing and this source of benefit for one. That is all that is implied in taking refuge. Perhaps then we could come to a close for this evening. It's been very wonderful to come together with everyone. Thank you very much for this very relaxed and positive gathering that we've had tonight, sharing these ideas. I feel that there is real potential for incredible benefit here in these kinds of ideas, concepts we've been discussing tonight, this whole concept of the six paramitas, of generosity and so forth, and these underlying principles of love and compassion, bodhicitta. All of these things are things that we can apply in our own lives, that we can bring out in our own lives, and the benefits that we can receive thereby are very great. Perhaps on that note then we could conclude the gathering with prayers to sincerely dedicate the merits and virtue of this teaching tonight for the benefit of all sentient beings, dedicating the merit of this to the enlightenment of all living things.
저로서 대수코 따와서 짜는다고 말했다. 딱딱치 치세진이 치인님을 따라 다녔자 생각이 아래
지우디 부부디
There is a story in one of the previous, again one of the previous birth stories of the Buddha, in which the Buddha was a small child, or at the time of the Buddha, in his lifetime was a small child. The small child came across a large pond full of thousands and thousands of fish, some 80,000 small fish, and there was a drought, and so the pond was slowly evaporating, drying up, and the fish were going to die. It was already very dangerously low, and the fish were starting to suffer, and the boy could see that they were going to die. And so the boy ran and made arrangements for all kinds of water to be pumped into this pond to bring the level back up, and then used to very happily feed the fish and recite mantras and prayers. And the story goes that these fish eventually did die, as all beings do, but that all of these fish were reborn in a god's realm because of the blessing of the mantras and prayers that the boy had.